supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead, we'll have details on the conclusion of testimony today of Bill Cosby's sexual assault trial. First, aggressive panhandling is on the upswing in Philadelphia. Experts say the opioid epidemic means more users are begging for drug money. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports that the city is trying to disrupt the practice through a texting campaign.
Instead of giving money to a panhandler, people can now text SHARE to the number 800-77 to donate to the city's Office of Homeless Services, says Department Head Liz Hirsch.
The funds that we get, we will put directly into real solutions, housing, jobs, and services.
The $5 donation will come right out of the texter's phone bill, and the city says it will match that contribution by reallocating some money from Hirsch's office.
It encourages generosity, but discourages panhandling as an economic activity.
That's Brian Abernathy, Philadelphia's deputy managing director. He says the texting program is part of a larger campaign and that the city needs to continue to expand daytime services for those down on their luck, increase drug treatment opportunities, and encourage low-barrier employment, such as selling the newspaper One Step Away. Hirsch says officials will assess the pilot by the end of September to see how well it's working. Mayor Jim Kenney says his approach to the issue has changed over his political career.
You can move people all day long, but if they're never going to get their issues resolved or solved or addressed, we're going to be moving people forever.
He's proposing $1 million more for homeless housing, which he says will translate into around 70 permanent housing units. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
A college guidance program in York, Pennsylvania is wrapping up its 10th year, helping more than 150 students get to college during that time. Those running the program say success goes beyond grades and SAT scores and hinges on helping kids deal with social issues. As part of our series, Grappling with Racial Tension, Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports.
In a classroom at William Penn High School, college acceptance letters cover a bulletin board taking up almost an entire wall.
Coppin, IUP, West Virginia, Towson, Westchester, Bowie, Lincoln, Spelman.
That's Mike Smith showing me the letters. They're for students in the local YWCA's Quantum Opportunities Program, which he runs. The program lets students earn money toward college by getting good grades and being accountable for their time outside school. They can bank up to $750 a year, plus $50 for every time they make honor roll.
Next year, I'm thinking about changing it to, it's this little thing that they call A's for J's. So A's will get you a pair of Jordans. Maybe in a year or so, it might be a financial situation because after a while, they'll all gravitate to that higher standard. That's how I got them from 2.0s to the average now, this 3.7 graduate.
The program also provides SAT prep, college tours, and other support for overcoming obstacles kids face in a city like York.
These kids know more people that went to jail than to college. That shouldn't be.
York's violent crime rate ranks 8th in the state, its poverty rate is 37%, and at William Penn, the police department has a full substation on a heavily traveled hallway.
All I want them to do is have options. When you got options, you know, you can figure out what you want to do.
As part of his job, Smith talks with families about where to send their kids to high school. For some, the York County School of Technology is a better academic option than their local public high school. Others choose tech so they can jump right into the workforce after graduating. But Smith says parents have become more hesitant recently about their kids going to tech due to something that happened there last fall. Senior Delicia Marshall, who's in Smith's program, recalled the day after the 2016 election.
It was like as soon as he won, we all knew the next day people were going to act up. And as soon as we went to school, it really was a problem. You got there and they're like, oh yeah, Trump won, Trump won.
That morning, a video was shot of York Tech students carrying a Trump sign through the hall while another shouted, "White power," from the edge of the frame.
White power!
The clip went viral.
I'm trying to sell the education piece. Regardless of that, even when you go to college, you're not going to be able to control how people act.
Yeah, it's really not a bad school. It really isn't. It's a good school.
That's Marshall jumping into the conversation with Smith.
Yeah, it always had like a reputation for being racist. Yeah. You're thinking, okay, yeah, Tech used to be racist. Okay, but there's a lot of African American and Hispanics that go to Tech now. So you're like, okay, maybe it's not going to be like that anymore. But then you do get there and you do experience that a little bit, and you're like, you don't know how to deal with it because you never dealt with it before.
For Marshall, this incident the day after the election was the culmination of racial tension that had been building for months, something stronger than what she described as the typical undercurrent at Tech, where the student body is 65% white, the majority, but still more diverse than the county overall.
School overall is good, and I'm glad that I went to that school because I learned a lot of things, not only about myself, but about school and about how I could further my education. It's just it's the select few of the student body that if you don't know how to deal with it, it could break you.
Marshall, who's going to college this fall out of state, was not among the dozens of students who left school early that day or maybe even stayed home the next because they felt unsafe. This gets to one of the points that Smith focuses on.
I really condition them to take that on their back. Don't let it stop them from being able to, because it's, you know, you're going to run across it here and there throughout life. It's just part of it.
Over the past decade, Smith has worked with over 150 teenagers, and all of them have gone to college. For him, success goes beyond grades. He also mentors the kids on how to deal with social issues, including racial tension.
At that age, I wish I would have knew what I knew now. So what I do is take what I know as a 49-year-old man coming up being a minority, all my experiences, and I give it to them so that when they face it, some of the stuff that I give them, they won't even face yet until later, but they'll have the equipment to be able to make the right decisions.
Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Bill Cosby's attorneys wrapped up their defense today, and now the sexual assault case is in the hands of 12 Pittsburgh jurors. Joining me now is WHYY's Laura Benchoff, who's been sitting in on the trial. Laura, what were the highlights from today?
So, Dave, we didn't get a ton that was new. We got one witness from the defense. They recalled a detective who had been heard earlier. Sorry if it's a little echoey. I am still in the courthouse. And we had closing arguments, which really just hit the high points as each side saw it, you know, going back over much of Cosby's deposition testimony, going back over the different statements, rehearing some of the phone calls he placed. So it was really just a recap and juror instructions.
I understand there was a big difference in style between the prosecutor and defense attorney.
That's pretty accurate. You know, Brian McMonagle is the lead defense attorney, and he is the showboating, extremely charismatic, like telegraphs exactly what he's feeling type of litigator. And he started his closing statements with a very personal appeal to the jury. He thanked them profusely, and he also really impressed upon them the human stakes of the case. And what, you know, his face is just so animated, you could tell he's really trying to pull out the feeling that he's showing from whoever he's talking to. Whereas the local district attorney, Kevin Steele, is much more of kind of a technocrat. He's very dry. He sticks very closely to the facts for the most part. You know, he walked jurors through forms that they were going to be seeing later about how to actually do the charging. And it was a very, you know, a study in contrast, if you will, between a certain kind of high-dollar defense lawyer and a publicly paid, you know, local DA.
Of course, the human elements of the case come down to two people, Bill Cosby and Andrea Constant. Review the evidence.
So the evidence against Cosby is largely in the form of witness testimony and phone call records and things like that. Andrea Constant testified last week over the course of a day and a half that Bill Cosby gave her drugs that he lied about the contents of to her, and which incapacitated her and left her vulnerable then to his sexual advances. She testified, her mother testified about the effect that had on Andrea and also some conversations that the mother had with Bill Cosby when she confronted him. There's civil deposition testimony that Cosby himself gave, in which he spoke, I guess, less guardedly than you would expect about the alleged assault and about some other women he had given quaaludes to in the 70s that he'd wanted to sleep with at the time. And then it was a lot of detectives sort of saying what they'd heard from both sides. And So a lot of it really does come down to who was there, who can corroborate what, you know, either side was saying. There's no physical evidence or anything like that. And then phone calls to kind of show that they had prolonged contact. That was something that the defense kept going back to try to undermine Andrea Constant's claims.
And so now it is in the hands of those 12 jurors from the Pittsburgh area. Review the judge's instructions.
So the judge spent, I would say, more than an hour really directing the jury how to weigh all these different kinds of evidence, what it means that another accuser was allowed to testify, you know, what's the burden of proof that they have to be weighing each piece of evidence against when they're trying to make a decision about how to find Bill Cosby on these three charges. So, you know, a lot of that is kind of procedural and dry, but it's also really a roadmap for them of how to do what they're going to do next. And he even went down into the nuts and bolts of what that is going to look like. You know, they're going to be kept in a room with a dry erase board and some pads, you know, pads of paper and pens. They're not going to have the internet. They're not going to have any tools at their disposal, really, besides their notes and these very low-tech tools to eventually arrive at their decision.
Given the quantity and quality of evidence presented in this now more than week-long case, is there a sense that this could be decided tonight, or is it apt to go longer?
You know, we really don't know. The judge has left it up to the jury to decide how late exactly they would like to deliberate. And while I can say we've had a long day in which we've all had everyone in the courtroom, you know, jurors and journalists alike have had to absorb a lot of information. It's really up to them how speedily they move. If they reach a decision at 11 p.m. tonight, that's kind of on them. Or if they want a break and come back to it, we just have to wait and see.
WHYY's Laura Benchoff reporting from the courthouse in Norristown. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision that made interracial marriage legal across the country. The court heard the case of Mildred and Richard Loving, a black woman and a white man who were jailed and then forced to leave their home state of Virginia after marrying. The Supreme Court unanimously ruled that state laws banning marriage between people of different races were unconstitutional. Farrah Parks and her husband Brad Linder have been documenting the stories of those in our region who are in interracial marriages as part of the Loving Project podcast. We've heard excerpts over the past few weeks, and Brad and Farrah join us now to share a few more of the stories they've heard. Farrah, Brad, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having us.
You've been chronicling the experiences of mixed-race couples since the start of the year. Which story or stories really stand out?
One interview that really stands out for us is Florence and Ed Goff. They met when they were both in college in Tennessee in the 1960s, and they got married in North Carolina in 1968. Interracial marriage had been illegal in both Tennessee and North Carolina before the ruling.
And when they started dating, they had no idea that it was illegal for them to get married. It wasn't until they got engaged that a family friend told them to keep an eye on the Loving case. And when the decision came down, they were able to get married in Florence's home state of North Carolina. Florence said that even though, you know, the decision came down and it was legal, they were still worried that someone would stop them and ask them to prove that they were married.
We did carry our marriage certificate in the glove compartment of our car.
That's right.
For at least 2 years, maybe, afterwards.
I think.
Because as we were visiting family and friends and stopping over at hotels, etc., we felt somehow that we might be called upon to prove that we had some legal status.
And it turns out they never really did have to show their certificate to anyone, so eventually they put it away.
But they told us they did face some scary situations in the early years when they started dating. For example, there was the time when the couple was driving through Indiana, when Florence says Ed noticed something strange.
I was not as aware as Ed was that there was a truck or a car following us. And they had
a truck with a cab, with a gun rack, with rifles in it. And they had their window down, and they would do up and back on the expressway. So the driver of the car would know they're paying real close attention to everybody that's in that car. And they knew one of them didn't belong.
After that experience, Ed actually got a gun and kept it in the glove compartment of their car whenever they were driving through certain areas. And he never told Florence about it until many years later after he'd actually gotten rid of the gun.
Farah, Brad, over the past 50 years, interracial marriage has become much more common. A Pew Research report put out last month finds 17% of newlyweds married someone of a different race in 2015, up from just 3% in 1967. So my question is, how did Florence and Ed summon the courage of their convictions at that time?
They both describe themselves as a very ordinary couple who just happened to meet and fall in love at an extraordinary time. But they did both have a strong sense of racial consciousness, and they were interested in civil rights issues. Ed grew up in Arkansas and remembers seeing the Army troops on their way to escort the first students to Little Rock High School after school desegregation. And Florence grew up hearing stories about sit-ins by African Americans at the segregated white-only Woolworths department store in Greensboro.
And when they met, Ed was immediately interested in Florence, but she had always grown up believing that white people weren't to be trusted. But eventually, you know, they got to know one another and they fell in love. Florence remembers Ed's mom calling her when he went to Arkansas to let his parents know that he was planning to marry her. And his mom was really, really upset.
The kind of thing, birds and fish don't mate.
And if you loved him, you would let him go.
Yeah, she did say that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't forget those conversations either, as hard and difficult as they were.
Eventually, the couple had two children, and Florence says she did form a relationship with Ed's mother, but it was always strained. Still, Florence thinks that things are better for interracial couples today.
I would be much less concerned if I were a young couple who had decided to have children, bringing them into the world today, as crazy as it is. When my granddaughter goes to school, she won't be the only biracial child in her classroom. And that makes a difference.
The Loving v. Virginia decision also had implications beyond interracial marriage. It paved the way for a more recent decision allowing same-sex couples to marry as well.
That's right. And we've also interviewed some couples who are in same-sex interracial marriages. For example, Melissa Hamilton and Michelle Satchel, they got married earlier in this year, but they'd actually been together for 12 years.
And they sort of have to deal with being both a lesbian couple and an interracial married couple, so that people sort of have weird reactions sometimes when they meet one of them. A person will be surprised to find out who the partner is, according to Michelle.
You know, I'll be like, oh, this is my wife, Melissa. And people are like, oh, okay. You know, like, oh, not only are you gay, but your partner is also white. Like, I was not expecting either of those things.
But overall, the most common thread through all the interviews we've done so far is that while couples in interracial marriages have to face some distinct challenges, I mean, two people who can come from very different places, very different backgrounds, have very different skin color, different religion, different nationalities, can come together, find common ground, fall in love, and form a family together.
Farah Parks, Brad Linder, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You can hear a longer version of this interview at newsworks.org. And you can find the Loving Project podcast on iTunes or go to lovingproject.com for more information. Philadelphia is the recipient of 5 John S. and James L. Knight Foundation City Challenge Awards for ideas intended to help residents contribute to their communities. Let's take a closer look with Patrick Morgan, Philadelphia Director for the Knight Cities Challenge, and Taib Smith, an announced grantee in this latest round. Taib, Patrick, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Dave.
Patrick, the project is in its third and final year. Talk about the City Challenge Awards.
The Knight Cities Challenge is actually a national challenge. So the Knight Foundation is a national foundation with strong local roots here in Philadelphia, as well as 25 other Knight communities where the Knight brothers owned newspapers at some time. So the city's challenge this year, we had more than 4,500 applicants across the country who gave us their ideas. And what we're asking for is all ideas be focused on one or more of what we see are the key drivers of city success, which are talent, opportunity, and engagement. And then from there, we went to around 144 finalists, and now we have around 33 winners, of which 5 of them are from Philadelphia. And I believe Philadelphia is slated to get, of the $5 million total share of the money, a little over $1 million will be coming to Philadelphia for these five ideas.
So Taib, describe this award for a dream deferred Philadelphia redlining, past, present, and future.
So we're looking to work with artists to create an installation to look at how redlining defined economic inequality in the region. So it's also, we're going to create a short documentary to also tell that story. To really have dialogue, you have to have empathy. And if you can't have some understanding of the history that created these spaces of inequality, or, you know, almost if you can imagine manufactured inequality, you can't have dialogue. And while cities are rapidly inverting and there's a lot of displacement happening, there's a lot of uncomfortable dialogue about the capital G word being gentrification. And I think gentrification means different things to different people depending on where you fall in economic stratus. So if you're moving into the city from the suburban rim, people often use gentrification as a positive verb. If you live within a neighborhood that it's experiencing displacement, oftentimes there's a generational pain to words like gentrification. And I think through kind of reimagining and redefining and educating people across all sides of the economic divide about the history of how our neighborhoods were divided, we'll have a better opportunity for dialogue and hopefully to affect public policy.
Past, present, what's the future aspect of your project?
Well, we want to, through data and data mapping, try to reimagine what these communities look like if they were properly monetized. Maybe to give a dream to the future of what could possibly be if we develop cities with a more of an ethical eye to development.
And Patrick, that seems to be part of the mission of the project, to make collaborative efforts across different strata to work towards solution.
Yeah, that's right, Dave. And I think, you know, when we look at an idea like a dream deferred, it's not just, you know, responding to Philadelphia and the opportunities and the challenges that come with growth, both, you know, current and historic, but it's also something that we feel, you know, could be lessons learned and applicable to one of our other night cities or communities, because we're not the only ones who, you know, are dealing with issues like this and issues around development. So an idea like this, where we can disseminate learning nationally and also is focused on, like I said, one or more of the key drivers of we see city success, you know, opportunity, engagement, and talent. I think clearly an idea like this hits on a number of those things.
Patrick Taib, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks, Dave.
Patrick Morgan, Philadelphia Program Director for the Knight Foundation, and award recipient Taib Smith. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.